Good morning. You're listening to author, activist, and journalist Cory Doctorow. I'll see you in the future.
Good morning! Welcome to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, episode 152 for February 23rd, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we've made it. Boy, oh boy, what a long journey to get here. But we are at the end of Recursion by Blake Crouch. It was a long journey. We had to read through it every time. What, like 9 times for 33 years to get to this end point.
Are we ever really at the end of a Recursion, Steve?
Ooh, a math question, Pam. Ooh, I understand the mathematical equation that is Recursion. No, I don't at all understand it. I know that it's just the same, but it's different based on what happened before. And it's just an eternal, infinite loop that our protagonist had to find a way out of at the end, huh?
Absolutely. It was, Bill Murray stars in it, and it happens up in, Ponca County, Phil. Yeah. Did I get that right?
No, not even close, but that's okay. That was close. Punxsutawney. Punxsutawney is, Phil is the name of the groundhog. Yeah, but okay, close enough.
So it's a little bit of a different tonality.
Maybe a little darker.
There were certainly, we've talked about this, there were dark parts of Groundhog Day. But in Recursion, it got to nuclear war at the end. So let's start with the easy question. How did you like these last sections of this novel, Pam?
Oh, I really, really enjoyed it. So I actually read all the way through to the end as soon as we finished recording our third podcast. One of the things that was really hard for me about this novel is it's a page turner. And so It's hard to read one part at a time, go off and do other things. I would have read this book in 1 or maybe 2 days if I had just picked it up on my own. So yeah, I really liked it. We'll come to the end. I was both super satisfied and also I had other ideas of where it was going to go. So I thought it was excellent, but I also was a little frustrated.
Chip, how did you like these last two books?
Well, I don't think I could read any book in 1 or 2 days, but this book certainly has a pace to it. It's a beautiful pace. And the word page turner is actually true. I mean, it's a book that just shoots you through momentum. I had a long drive that I used to finish up the last section, and it was wonderful. I enjoy this. I think this would make a fantastic movie or miniseries, and there's a lot of fun ideas to explore. And we'll see if it's Back to the Future type level. You never know.
Yeah, I can see the cinematic quality of this writing, where Blake Crouch certainly has a thriller mindset here. This is definitely in the genre of sci-fi thriller, and those action moments, I brought up the thermonuclear war, that moment in this book where they are racing against time, literally dying from exposure to this nuclear weapon and getting to the solution where they need to be. That is so well written, and the cinematic quality of it, the movie / TV series, I am ready to see that on screen.
Absolutely agree. And I was kind of curious by the way that he wrote the narrative perspective in the final two books. So after moving between the two narrators for the first three books, book four is narrated entirely by Helena, and book five entirely by Barry. Mm-hmm. I was curious what you guys thought about that. What are the affordances of picking a perspective and sticking with it? And what do you think was lost? Would you have liked a bit more back and forth? What were you thinking about the narrative perspectives?
I absolutely loved the beginning of it, where you noted that the two third-person narrations were focused on two very separate stories, and you said in the first episode, that's the way a romance novel sometimes goes. And I knew that these two protagonists were going to be romantic partners by the end of this book, and I didn't tell you in episode one, Pam, but...
You didn't have to, because I also knew by that point.
that perspective, those two congruent stories getting together, and then the narration being focused on the couple together in the middle portion, and then separate again for books 4 and 5. I love that. I think that we get such a great idea of separate in the beginning, together in the middle, and then again separate. And the emotion of feeling that separation at the end is hard to attain, and Blake Crouch really gave us that.
I had not really even thought about that. I was just experiencing the book, but that is interesting that you would go back to a single narrator for the last book, and the writer made that choice. And I'm wondering if that's because, you know, I don't know how many books Crouch has written, but if that was on purpose, or if that was, you know, a conscious decision by the author, or if a more seasoned writer would make it more back and forth. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that, Pam?
Well, Crouch is a very seasoned writer, and so this was definitely a conscious decision. But I guess I found it a little bit odd that he basically didn't show us their love at all. He just told us, oh, and they're totally in love, like forever. And they're soulmates, and they, like, trust me, it's true. He didn't really show it to us. Like, think about Time Traveler's Wife, right? Think about how Audrey Neffenegger actually made you feel, rather than just relying on narrative conventions. Like, oh yeah, this is like a standard dual narrator romance thriller, and like, trust me, they're in love with each other. And so it was so funny, because I kept thinking when we were going into that recursive loop, I didn't believe their soulmateness the way that I suppose I could have, in the way I think that Steve, you did. And maybe that's part of like a worldview thing, but I actually kept thinking, like, guys, if you're going to solve this loop, you guys might want to step outside of just the two of you. You might do better to like see if you can get someone else involved. Like, sticking with just the two of you is obviously not working. You need to get outside that we're soulmates, trust me, loop. And so that's what I kept expecting. And that's why I thought he had left Helena out, was I thought Barry was going to go ahead and do that. And he did, in a way. But anyway, so
I think they tried. I think they tried to get to the other characters in the lab to try to motivate them to be a part of the solution. And I think that all of the times they tried that, it failed.
No, I just meant like maybe the two of them weren't the right people to stop it. Like, if I was Helena, I would have like maybe chosen a different partner. Maybe you don't always go back to Barry. Maybe, you know what I'm saying?
He's the John McClane, Pam. He is the diehard, the hardened, seasoned cop who has seen some stuff. He's the right character for this story, for me, and definitely the right character for a movie and TV show version of this. I want John McClane.
I think you just hit it there, Steve. I mean, I think it's perfectly reasonable. Why would you stay with the same person? But on the grand part, if you're writing a movie, you got to have your characters. And you're right, he's the seasoned cop.
The character of the seasoned cop is what I want. Yes, the economy of characters in a movie would definitely play into this. But I want the seasoned cop. That's the show that I want, for sure.
Blake Crouch uses a lot of conventions, right? All those genre conventions we just talked about, including the seasoned cop and, of course, the like loner genius woman. Now, he also introduces a lot of new terms, because he has to, you do in science fiction, in order to explain what's happening. And so I actually thought there were some really cool neologisms or new terms. One of the things he mentioned often is dead memories.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that you've experienced something that's in a different timeline. And so you still have the memory, but it's a dead memory in that timeline no longer exists. And this really reminded me of one of just a classic tale of American literature, Bartleby the Scrivener by Herman Melville. Have you guys read that book?
No, we are ignorant. Tell us all about it.
Well, it's a novel.
Notice how I answered for Chip.
I feel like it's like a very commonly read novel by English majors. No one else. It's very, very good. And it's about this guy, Bartleby, who gets hired by a lawyer. And when the lawyer says, oh, could you do all these jobs? He's very, very good. And then one day he says, I would prefer not to. And so it gets really excessive. Like the lawyer's like, can you do this? I would prefer not to. And then eventually he's like, I'm going to have to fire you. I would prefer not to. I'm going to have to kick you out of the office. I prefer not to. The lawyer ends up moving offices and just leaving this guy. Anyway, but it turns out that the psychology of Bartleby comes back to the fact that he used to be in charge of delivering dead letters, which are letters that were just never delivered for whatever reason. And that notion of people writing communications that are meaningful, but that don't make it to the intended because the intended person died or they moved or whatever reason, that notion that dead letters can actually like wear you into completely not being able to function as a member of society. It comes back to these dead memories. And I kind of liked that term. And I wondered if Crouch was referencing that very, very famous novella in this notion that when you have memories that are real to you, but that no one else shares, you become less and less functional. And we see that, of course, as through the recursions, that each time, especially Helena's mind becomes a little bit less able to function.
And we see that the people that have memories of their own deaths have such a hard time living their lives because they have this vivid but yet still very shadowed memory, these dead memories. Yeah, I didn't even think of that because Crouch lays that out so completely. This is what's happening. So I just accepted it. I didn't even acknowledge this idea of dead memories being artificial.
Right. It's like a new idea. And then I thought another term that was super cool was reality theft. And this notion that someone who's controlling the chair is changing your reality and stealing your reality from you. And this is what actually leads to the global conflict, is that the US gets accused of reality theft. Now, what anxiety, you know me as a leader, what anxiety do you think that taps into from today?
I think that this is an obvious reference to the idea of fake news and alternative facts, which was the conversation that we were having at the time when Blake Crouch wrote this book. I think that that's what we're talking about, is the idea of reality theft. You are trying to tell me that this is true when I know for certain that it's the opposite. That's mentally unstable to have those ideas in your head at the same time.
Well, any person who's watched any of the news channels, the 24-hour news channels, you can see how any one of them, you get this sort of, I don't know, this myopic view of the world. Like, you know, one side's good and the other side's bad, and how could they be so evil? And it's sort of, I mean, right before the election, probably came right to the head of it. In fact, after the election, it came to the head of it when they stormed into Washington. Mm-hmm. That's a result of, you know, reality theft, this idea that you can't trust your view of the world. In fact, I even saw an interview where It was a Russian former spy was talking about how espionage and espionage, that's what you do to a country, how you can make it collapse is stealing its reality, stealing what makes your narrative that makes your society work. And I'm sure, I mean, this was a Russian spy giving this talk, but it could be for any espionage group about how to make a society collapse.
Sure, this notion of misinformation and the power of misinformation. Now, one thing that I found really odd, and I don't know if you guys would agree with this, is that after like such cool terms as the dead memories, the reality theft, I'm like, memory chair? Is that what this technology is called? The memory chair? Now, it's not like I'm like, it should have been called Awesome Thing X, but that was a little bit less fancy, I suppose.
Apple's memory chair would have been so much better.
It would have been triple the price, though.
Now, you guys, another anxiety that I think Crouch was really tapping into, again, publishing in 2019, so writing in this right at this period, he mentioned specifically WikiLeaks, right? So within this novel, people learn how to make memory chairs because the schematics get shared on WikiLeaks. Now, as you very well know, this is a super controversial website. And as we've talked about many, many, many interesting things in this show, I realized I don't actually know how you guys feel about WikiLeaks. Are you guys for or against the idea of unlimited open information?
Isn't that interesting?
But I realize we haven't talked about it.
You come down both sides. I mean, Snowden certainly, Edward Snowden, is he a hero or is he an evil person? And I think, you know, the information that was released by Snowden through WikiLeaks seems to have been true and certainly has, while it hurt, I guess, U.S. spy interests, it really did illuminate a lot of stuff that people suspected and painted into those fears. I like, in theory, the idea of WikiLeaks. I like, in theory, about what this... what it was able to do. It was able to expose sort of some of the challenges that we have in society today. And these are things that our news sources seem to be abandoning and not addressing for any number of reasons. So I have no problem with WikiLeaks, but I can understand from national defense point of view, you know, spies, something like that, mm-hmm. how this could be detrimental and certainly could hurt relations. So, I don't know. I mean, it goes back and forth.
The idea that you started with is Edward Snowden was revealing the truth to the American people and thus to the world. If we assume that what he is telling us is true, I think it's important that we have knowledge of that action, all of that spying that was happening, and we really keep our eye on all of those people who have access to that information. That said, yes, we need some secrecy. There is some amount of information that should not be leaked that would be in the national interest to keep private. Just like in your private life, keeping your passwords secure keeps your individual financial and other information private.
Well, no one cares if you steal your Chicago Tribune password. So, I mean, there are some things that, you know, who cares? Other things are much more important. And on the grand scheme of things, I think we've had three presidents, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. All three of them had the opportunity to pardon Snowden. All three of them chose to ignore it. So there's something else going on there that is, you know, even if the truth is released, that, you know, they're not pardoning him. But we now have Biden, and, you know, if I'm wrong with George W., but I think it's been a while since Snowden did this. But, you know, I can't think of the guy's Assange, who was the person who
Julian Assange.
And he's basically, not house arrest, but, he's on the run, isn't he? Was he arrested? Yeah. So, you can see that even if your sources, you know, illuminate something like this, you're putting yourself at risk. And, you know, thank goodness for investigative journalism, but it seems to me that we're missing some of those elements that, or they're choosing to work in some areas and not in other areas. That certainly would be of interest to the public.
What do you think, Pam?
Oh, same. I can't decide.
You proposed a question that has no answer. Fine. Yes. No,
that's why it's such a great topic to for Crouch to explore, right? And obviously in this novel, he's showing us like a really, really, really negative consequence of WikiLeaks. But I think you can, you know, we can go to Cory Doctorow and get like a much more positive representation. So I think you can have, you know, you can have representations of these kinds of sites that range from utopian to flat out apocalyptic like this one. And I think there's plenty to support all of those representations.
And you bring up Cory Doctorow. His big push is for encryption, to keep the private things private, to make sure that you are secure in your communication so that things like the Snowden reveal that the government might be snooping on your stuff can be prevented. So that's the other perspective on that for sure.
Either something's secure or it's not. Mm-hmm. And not to go too crazy on it, we all think that our, I don't know, our text or whatever are so, you know, important to be secure. Many things are not, but on the grand scheme, it either is or it isn't. And this idea that a person with a special set of skills could come in and unwind your personal data and share it to the world. I mean, certainly could be incredibly damaging.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's very much understood today. And I mean, I think this notion of privacy, we middle-aged people such as ourselves, we're the last generation that has any vestige of like, oh, I have personal privacy. And some of us, not even very much. I feel like it's like people who are younger than us, they don't value privacy at all. People who are older do, but young people don't value privacy. And I don't see why they would.
But the other interesting fact that I see with my students and my boys is that they don't value saving any of this data. They want to take a picture and they want that picture to go away after a certain amount of time. They don't want to look back at 5 years ago when we had this event. They want it completely off the table, which is interesting.
Changes in temporality, right? I really do think we're experiencing some shifts in how we think about time, memory, perception, data, and as well we should think about all of our technological changes. Of course, they impact our perceptions.
And we get in this story with all of that shift, all of those changes, we get such great emotion. Blake Crouch is able to write about every possible human emotion in this book. It's amazing how, okay, Pam, you said you didn't see the love between our two main characters in here as presented as anything other than total narrative. They fell in love. I heard the feeling that Barry expressed about how much he saw Helena as his soulmate, that they could find each other anywhere. Maybe that's me applying that idea from The Time Traveler's Wife, where they are absolutely destined to be together. But I saw it in there.
Awesome. I love that you saw that. That's great. I don't know what to say. Like, I thought it was a very tell, don't show kind of romance, but it very nicely relied on all of the generic conventions, starting right from the dual narrator. I love that you saw that, and I will look out for it on the next.
Fine. There's also.
I'm sorry.
There's also.
Were you like super invested in the romance or soulmate element of this?
Don't ask him.
Secondary. I'm gonna win this one, Steve. We'll go to the referee. Christopher Hessenflo will be able to answer this for us.
Oh, answering the question, you know, that is the thing you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to, you know, sort of show this. I'm sorry. You're not supposed to tell this. You're supposed to have it kind of, you know, become more natural. Anyway.
Okay. So, Chip, when we read Time Traveler's Wife and you said that it was a book for women,
yes.
Is this a book for men?
No.
Uh-oh, you just love Steve.
It's a book for a general audience.
And I completely bought how much Barry loved his daughter. That I thought was super, super well done. Just so. Mm-hmm. So I actually thought that it wasn't that Crouch wasn't able to show Barry's, you know, emotional range. I really, really believed not only the love for the daughter, but also the amount of guilt that he carried from her death in that first timeline. So I actually thought, I thought there was a lot of really, really great emotional investments throughout the novel. I just thought that the romance itself was a little bit less well rendered than the other emotions. Obviously, the fear was awesome.
Yeah.
Guilt true. Was excellent.
True actual fear. That climactic moment that we've already said three times. There's this nuclear explosion, and our main characters...
Can I say that? Can I say nuclear?
You and I say that word a little differently, Steve, but there you go.
I don't hear the difference in the way I say it versus the way you say it. I don't know what it is about my brain. How do you say it?
Nuclear.
That's what I said. That's the same word. It's the same thing.
I forgot about nuclear. Isn't that the interesting thing is that how we say this word?
It's the same. That's no different. This is not an Abbott and Costello sketch. That's the same word. I said it the same way you did. There's a bomb.
Aluminium.
It's all about perspective, my friends. Hey guys, can I just bring up something that I read this very morning in a book called Perception by Dark Prophet and Drake Bear? It's so interesting. And Steve, you'll find this fascinating. There's a study where people are asked to do pretty complicated math. They're given a data set and they're asked to do pretty complicated math. And then you're shown if they do it correctly or not. Some people are good at the math and some people aren't, and that's okay. But here's the finding, is that when the data sets are about politically sensitive topics, like gun control, for example, people make mathematical errors in order to support their own political views.
Well, that's the premise of the book I'm reading.
Really?
The idea is that people get pretty sloppy with their data sets, they get pretty sloppy with the conclusions of their data, reading into it. And even when called out on it, many people are afraid to speak because, especially if it's a powerful group. So anyway, it works in a lot of areas. I think there was, I can't remember, 3 or 4 years ago where there was the conversation of whether a lot of the psychology conclusions, whether they could recreate the findings of these paper, and most of them couldn't be. And in fact, that it was pretty damning to a lot of the research that's being put out right now. So, the idea of science is you should be able to recreate it. And
our perception and our point of view certainly changes what we observe. That's some quantum physics right there. It's the observation.
And it comes right back to this question about reality theft, right? This anxiety, as we learn more and more about how, but like the reproducibility of science experiments. I love that you brought that up, Chip. That's such an important study from a couple of years ago and works right into this notion that like, what is truth? What is reality? So the epistemological questions that we have and how we're now applying them to temporality itself. It really speaks to exactly the moment we're in 2021, in 2019, when Crouch is writing this. So these are super important topics. And I love that we read Time Traveler's Wife as part of this book club as well, because I think it's really important that Audrey Niffenegger is writing a sequel to that, like right now. again, and a bit of an unusual sequel that comes so many years later, but that I think is going to be relevant in an entirely different way because of the way that our thinking about temporality has changed. Yeah, were you guys reminded of Time Traveler's Wife at all as you're reading Recursion?
I totally was. In fact, I was almost mixing them up at times.
Ooh, because, okay.
And that's because I'm driving and I'm listening and I just kept going, okay, because there are a lot of parallels into sort of how time works. It's a different way of putting together the time travel part and the alternate reality part, but it's certainly, I could see that. There's certainly, if we were going to package these recordings, they certainly could be packaged together.
Yeah, that idea of living a life over time where you know where you're going to get to. You have that finish line because of time travel, but you still have to go through all of the time to get there. I'm very much reminded of Time Traveler's Wife with this. I'm also reminded of 11/22/63, the Stephen King time travel story, where the protagonist has to go through a decade's worth of living to get to the finish line that he knows exists on that date, where he goes to save John F. Kennedy from assassination. The idea of solitude traveling through time, you are on your journey. You might know where you're headed, but to get there, you have to get through every day, is definitely a message of this book.
Well, and I like, there's so many wonderful passages about the nature of time. I think especially in book 5, narrated by, or focalized rather, by Helena, where she says, "My moment feels just as real to me as yours does to you. Are they both real? Is it only our consciousness that makes it so?" And this is when she and Barry are meeting before he can remember her. She remembers him perfectly because she's been here before, and he's just meeting her for the first time. I really like those sort of reflections. And she also notes, even more globally, we are intelligent enough to be aware of the illusion of time, even as we live by it.
Hmm. So is it Bill or Ted who goes, "Whoa"?
There's a lot of whoa moments in books 4 and 5, aren't there, Chip?
There are. This certainly was an excellent adventure, Steve.
It with a lot of danger. Boy, a lot more danger than Bill and Ted ever got to. But there's so many moments in here in this story where you, as the reader, are thinking about the illusion of time, thinking about the illusion of memory. It was so great to hear from Jamie last week, where she explained that there are real experiments where we can really put false memories into a human. That is ground shaking. I have to think, is that a moment that really happened, or was it just on the Muppet Show?
Right.
Good point, Steve. I think all of us have come to that conclusion. Right?
The Muppets, by the way, the Muppet Show is available on Disney Plus, and it started on Friday, so that's all I've been doing since Friday.
Excellent. Well, and I love that Jamie said, what we all know is true, but we don't always think about. Like, we have false memories all the time. We misremember things constantly. And when we check in with our siblings or childhood friends about, events that we were both at, and we have such different notions of what might have happened.
So the hero's journey is not my journey?
No. It is for you, Chip.
I'm the protagonist of this story. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, and I like near the end when Barry's hanging out in the Antarctic, it's about -80 degrees Fahrenheit. And he says, on a night like this, time feels secondary to the true prime mover, memory. Wow. And that idea of time and memory as, capital T, capital M characters who have a big impact on our lives.
So note to self, if I'm ever asked to give a toast or something like that, have this quote available to me. Because this is a great quote.
It is a great quote. It is a great quote. But isn't that what time travel stories are all about? Is really memory, that nostalgia. Nostalgia was brought up in book five as well as a driving force to certain actions of today. That idea that memory is more powerful than time itself. That's I dig that.
Yeah. Are we ready to go to the end of this novel?
Okay, I have to ask first.
Yes.
Did you love the cinematic ending, the way that all of the things were resolved in the last, 5 minutes of the story? It's very Star Trek.
Now, I must admit that I figured that after Barry fixed everything, he wouldn't remember anything. And that's how we would know that he had succeeded. And I don't know why he remembered, actually. Like, within the mechanism, I am a bit confused of why he would remember all those dead memories.
Because he was the one who did the traveling. So he was the only one who had those memories, because all of those events were erased by his actions.
I thought they would be erased for him too, but
He's the one who did the traveling. This is Quantum Leap. This is going back in time to fix. Oh, we could do it. Let's do another show, Pam, where we rewatch Quantum Leap. Going back in time to fix something that once went wrong.
Right. I really liked that. As we're nearing the end, Barry has this moment. He's sort of overcome with all the memories. And he says, what feels real is the breath going in and out of his lungs. And as you guys know, I'm a big fan of yoga. And that is exactly the kind of thing a yoga teacher says. You know, don't think of anything. Just feel the breath going in and out of your lungs. And that's a way that you kind of step outside of time. Stay in the body. Let time do what it does. And so I kind of like that little new agey moment.
Well, and it's also that moment of being in the absolute present. If you're conscious of the breath coming in and out, you're in the most present time you can be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mindfulness. We have studied mindfulness on Too Much Scrolling many times. We've read several books about mindfulness. We've had several authors, including Dan Harris from ABC News, who wrote a book about mindfulness and how not to be a jerk, because he's not a nice guy.
Yeah, I must admit, I really, really loved the very end of this novel. I thought it was great. What do you say, and this is in Barry's vocalization, what do you say to the bravest woman you've ever known, whom you've lived a half dozen extraordinary lives with, whom you saved the world with, who saved you in every conceivable way, but who has no idea you even exist? Barry takes a sip of beer and sets down the glass. The air feels electrically charged, just like before a storm. Questions avalanching through his mind. Will you know me? Will you believe me? Will you love me? Scared, exhilarated, senses heightening, heart thrumming, he turns finally to Helena, who, feeling his attention, looks over at him through those jade green eyes. And he says, oh yeah, that's a good ending.
That's great. That's great. That is,
What does he say? No,
what can he say? How can he start this conversation? Where does it start? That's the romance. Where does it start? What is the first thing? I think about all of those words that Blake Crouch gave us here. Scared, exhilarated, senses heightening, heart thrumming. He is putting us, the reader, into the head of this character so well by describing those internal ideas.
And it's so funny how romancy this is. Like, thrumming is a verb you seldom read outside of a romance novel, as is that jade green adjective.
Oh, yeah. The so fact that she is a redhead with green eyes, yeah, that's not lost on me, my friend.
I'll have to pick it. I'm going to put coming into my vocabulary. That would be a great word to use.
The generic play here is great. You know, I love that. Ooh, it's a thriller, a sci-fi thriller, with like this weird romance ending. I love it.
I loved this ending. This is very much like the ending of The Sopranos, which I don't... Pam, have you watched The Sopranos?
I've come in and out. I watched it through. Sorry.
Okay. The ending is very similar to this. The audience is put into a situation wherein we don't know what happens next, and it is left completely up to the audience's imagination. And it is stunning. The literal use of that word, where I wanted to know more. I wanted to hear. I wanted to see. And nope. Story's over.
Love it.
So I hope that you enjoyed this book as much as I did. I look forward to the cinematic quality of this being put onto our screens soon. I hope that we see a wonderful representation of this. And I have high hopes, because like we said a few weeks ago, this has been picked up by Netflix, and Shonda Rhimes is the head of this production. So I have high expectations.
I do too, and it's a great narrative. I'm really glad you brought this to us, Steve. Thank you.
So next week, we start our 9th book in the book club. As what? Amazing as that sounds, 9 books in Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. So Chip, it's your turn once again. What is our next assignment?
We are going to go back to graphic novels. And I think we're going to do, in fact, I know we're going to do, Rassel by Jeff Smith. And for many of our listeners, if they have young children, they may know that... there's a story called Bone, maybe a fantasy type story that Jeff Smith is known for. He started working on it in the 80s and spent a long time. And certainly it's a wonderful book. And for any person who has a young person who's struggling reading, Bone may be a good place to go. But after he completed Bone, he wrote sort of a science fiction, noir, conspiracy story that has to do with alternate realities, uses Native American mythology and symbolism, and uses a lot of the tropes that we may enjoy. In fact, it fits real well with this story. And ooh, so it's called Rassel. Yeah. It's called Rassel. It's from 2009. That's when it first began. And we're going to divide it up into 4 programs. So our first part is going to be chapters 1 through 3. It's called The Drift. And this will get us into this story.
Excellent. It's interesting how we have very similar tastes, and at the same time, we have very different tastes. And I love that you're bringing to us another graphic novel. And Jeff Smith is well known for Bone. I do have some autographed copies of Bone sitting around here somewhere. And maybe, just maybe, Jeff Smith could join us to explain Rassel to us.
Now, I want to tell you that this story was originally presented in black and white, but many of the copies you're going to get, or our listeners will get, will be colored. No big deal. Jeff Smith saw who was going to color it and made sure it was to his liking. But if you get a black and white one, that's perfectly fine to read along to. The story remains the same.
Excellent. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
What do you think, Pam?
Absolutely. I'm excited to come back next week and read Rassel.
But we don't have to do it over and over and over and over again anymore, because we're done with recursion, right?
Well, we can listen to the program over and over and over, Steve. We can keep living it. It's like Groundhog's Day, Steve.
Wonderful. I hope everybody out there is enjoying our conversations along with us and getting ready for Rassel, which is our next book. We'll start reading that next week. Find your copy and read along with us. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasselblad.
And I'm Pam Fedor. So we don't
we'll see you in the future. Now that we're out of the recursion.